Time for our RSN Legends series to continue today, and we're on the eve of an Indian summer, so to speak. The world of cricket is going to continue, and we're going to have the Indians here, who are one of the most formidable teams on the planet. And one man who debuted against the Indians in 1985-86 went on to play 53 tests for Australia and score 1,000 runs. That's just with the bat, of course. So 212 wickets, 33 one days, 100 runs on the dot with 38 wickets, and one of the most fabulous moustaches in the history of sport across the globe. It's the one and only Merv Hughes, who joins us on the Legend Series. Good morning, Swervin.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
We are very, very well. Now, we're going to talk about that the Indians coming across and your debut against the Indians in 1985-86. What floods back to your memory?
Probably at the end of the game, the biggest thought I ever had, will I ever play another test match? One for 123, a fifth ball duck and a couple of drop catches. It wasn't a great debut in test cricket, but obviously got the opportunity to play. And probably for me was just the step up. I mean, all cricket games, it doesn't matter what level you play, is that bowling field, but the margin for error to international batsmen is slight, and we came up against Sunil Gavaskar, who made 160 not out in that game, and just bowling to him, dead set did my brain. It was just very, very hard work, and realised when I finished that game that you had to improve and had to step up a little bit more.
It's one of the things they talk about a lot, from state teams to, definitely in terms of cricket, state teams to international teams, where you might be one or two really good players in the state team, but when you get to the international level, they're all awesome, and you've got no idea until you get there that what it looks like. Is that what you found?
Yeah, pretty much. I'd had a pretty good education through first club cricket. We had Ron Gaunt, who was an ex-international, that was a bowling coach down there. And we had Ken Eastwood, who played one test match, but played a lot of cricket for Victoria. And had Lindsay James, who was an outstanding coach. And then got into the Victorian team. And Ian Redpath had taken over. And he brought in Alan Connolly and Keith Stackpole. And what they did, they prepared us to play hard-fought first-class cricket and tried to prepare us for test cricket. But basically, you find out that there's just no preparation. You're thrown in at the deep end, and now there's not too many blokes that just take it by the horns and run with it. So yeah, had a tough day there, and probably Ian Cullen, former Victorian fast bowler, played a fair bit of cricket with him, and he summed it up pretty easily in one sentence to me. He said the difference between test cricket, state cricket, club cricket is, in club cricket, you can bowl a bad ball every over and get away with it. At state cricket, you can bowl a bad ball every couple of overs and get away with it. At international cricket, every bad ball you bowl gets hit. So those words were sort of echoing in my ears when I was halfway through my first bowling spell. Just anything just a little bit over pitch, a little bit wider, a little bit short, just got absolutely met by the Indians, and it was a tough debut.
So, Merv, you'd sort of played 4 or 5 years of Victorian cricket before you got your chance at international cricket. Were you close for a while? Take us through the selection process when it finally took place.
I'd had a probably injury hit 5 years, to be honest. So I played the back half of 1 year. Then I played the first half of the next year, was out for the back half through injury. Then I probably knew I was getting close. 1983, they had this thing, used to be a SO scholarship. So 4 young players each year got picked from Australia to go over to the UK and play, and had the opportunity with that. The other 3 my year were Robbie Kerr from Queensland, Mike Hazen from South Australia, and Greg Matthews from New South Wales. So that was probably an early sort of indication that the selectors had identified you as possibly being up to the standard. So that gave me a lot of hope. And to go over to England, I played for Essex Seconds, and Mike Dennis, the former English captain, was captain of the second 11, and he was absolutely fantastic. So All along the way, I've just really had good, strong leadership and really intelligent sort of guys at the helm to lead in the right direction.
And you sort of, I mean, obviously throughout your entire time with Australia, but you seem to have a really close relationship with Alan Border, and he really backed you in, and you became such an integral part of that team. How did that relationship develop?
It didn't start too well, I've got to be honest. when I first got in the side, a little bit of nervous energy, I suppose, and Alan Border was the one that nicknamed me Fruit Fly because he said I was Australia's biggest pest. I think that was about 15 minutes into having sort of spent time with him at training and that. So, but yeah, listen, Alan Border was fantastic. It was at the time he was under a fair bit of pressure too. He'd just taken on the captaincy. We'd lost a heap of more experienced and senior blokes to the Rebel Cool to South Africa. And Alan Border was fantastic. He copped a lot of criticism from the media for being unsure and unsupportive on the ground. But, mate, we knew as players exactly what was expected from us. AB used to talk to us before the day's play, at drinks, during the break. He'd never make a big deal about it. If you're going bad, he never made a big deal about it on the ground. He'd just pull you aside and have a bit of a chat about what you're doing wrong and possibly what you could do to turn it around. So, as I said, to have great leadership, it just makes it easier. And Bob Simpson, my first test match was his first test match as coach. And as I said, Alan Border had just taken over, and AB just threw into a fantastic captain.
You were an energetic cricketer, Merv. You were a great competitor, as anyone who watched you play would attest to. Did anyone try and curtail that or rein that in when you got to the national level, that you may have been going over the top?
No, not really. We just got... I was always told and express yourself as a kid, so if you're having a good time, let it be known. It didn't really shine through the first couple of years I played because of the nerves, because of the uncertainty of being there. I really didn't feel secure in the Australian side to even... probably halfway through the 89 tour to England. So I was in and out of sides, got picked for England in 89 and probably wasn't going to play too much. And Carl Rackerman got injured. So the opportunity opened for myself, and I suppose it was between Greg Campbell and myself. And I got a few wickets in that first test match, and we only used the 12 players throughout that series. So to be on the sidelines would have been hard. So if you missed that first test match, it was going to be really hard to get in because the team did so well. So I had the opportunity, and to have Terry Alderman and Jeff Lawson in England in 89, they played a lot of cricket in England, and especially Terry Alderman, but take nothing away from Jeff Lawson. They were very helpful for me over in England 89, just a young buck learning off the old bulls. It was fantastic.
And that series was one of my favourites of all time, that 89 Ashes series. Was that the signalling of a real start of the dominant era for Australian cricket, do you think?
I think the start half actually happened 2 years before it. And to be honest, 4 years before. So 1985, when Bob Simpson was appointed coach, Alan Border was appointed captain, and a bloke by the name of Laurie Sewell from West Australia was appointed chairman of selectors. And they just... Probably, I reckon their motto would have been short-term pain, long-term gain. It was, if you could bat and bowl, that's great, but everyone at that level can. What you've got to do is bring more to the table. So what they tried to do, and Bob Simpson's plan was to make us the best fielding team in world cricket. And that started to sort of shine through in 87 when Australia, and I wasn't part of that, the World Cup in India, Pakistan, they won that. But our test results had sort of turned around. We weren't being beaten 3-0 in test series. We were being beaten 2-1 or 1-0. And a lot of people sit back and say, well, that doesn't make any difference. And the thing about test cricket is if you're not good enough to win, you can be good enough to stop the other team from winning. And if you can do that, you're on your way to being a pretty good side. And certainly if you have a look at the results from the time, Alan Border and Bob Simpson were appointed to 1989, so 4-year period. We just slowly turned it around without having that, I suppose, satisfaction of winning. But certainly in 89, I suppose all the moons aligned. We got Terry Alderman, Carl Rackman and Trevor Holmes back. Went over to England. Alan Border played over there for a while. Most of the team had been together for about 4 years, so we're just starting to grow in confidence. And, just all clicked. Terry Alderman was outstanding. Jeff Lawson took a heap of wickets. Mark Taylor, Steve Waugh made a heap of runs, and we're on our way.
Merv, you talked earlier about bowling to Sonny Gavaskar in your first game. When you look back on your career, who was the one guy that you didn't want to have to bowl to?
Adam, I love bowling against the best. So I suppose any sportsman, it doesn't matter what sport you play, you pick yourself against the best. So to shy away from a situation was just... Yeah, it just wasn't on, I suppose. But probably early doors, I had a few problems with a South Australian left-hander by the name of David Hook. And I look back as a young bloke and think, well, I probably wasn't the only one that had a little bit of trouble with him. And he taught me a lot of valuable lessons about overcoming probably a little bit of anxiety, because he certainly got hold of me the first couple of times we played against him, and then to come up against him year after year, you just had to find a way. I mean, if you sort of backed off and tried to shy away from it, it didn't help the situation. So you just had to work it out. But Sonny Gavaskar was a fantastic player. Viv Richards, early in my career, for two different reasons. Viv was very attacking, and Sonny Gavaskar was a death by a thousand cuts. Just used to bat for a long time and wear the opposition down. And then later in my career, no surprises with Brian Lara and Sachin Tendulkar. They were fantastic young players, but Michael Atherton was probably the toughest competitor that I played against. He was fantastic for England when England were going not so well against Australia.
Right, okay. Now, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, about there was a particular game at the MCG late in the day where you took three top order West Indian wickets, and there were some big names. Richie Richardson was part of all of that. But I just want you to share with our listeners that feeling of playing at the MCG and having that crowd behind you, because you were such an iconic figure, whether it be fielding down at fine leg or coming into bowl at the MCG. What was that feeling like?
Oh, no better place to play, to be honest. And we used to have these discussions with the New South Wales boys about the best ground in Australia, and they used to say, of course, the SCG, and we used to say the MCG, and the conversation was always cut short when you just point out to them that if they were happy playing in front of 42,000 people, so be it, but if you want to play in front of a big crowd, come to the MCG. So that used to shut them up a bit. But, I've always maintained there was only one thing better than being in the Australian side playing at the MCG, and that was being a Victorian in the Australian side playing at the MCG. The support that we got from our home base crowd, and it was no different. If we went up to Brisbane and Alan Border hit a four, the applause would be just a little bit more because of him being a Queenslander. Mark and Steve Waugh, Mark Taylor hit a boundary, or Jeff Lawson got a wicket in Sydney, the roar would just be a little bit higher. So everywhere you went, you had that sort of state, I suppose, bias. And you come to Victoria, and when we're playing, whether it was a day-night match in front of 60,000, 70,000 people or Boxing Day in front of 80,000 people, the support that we got as Victorians was absolutely fantastic, and can't fault the Victorian guys, and especially all my mates in Bay 13. To go down and field in front of Bay 13 and the support that I got from down there, I mean, that was my demographic, wasn't it? Just guys down there on the field. And that's where I would have been if I hadn't have been playing, I suppose.
They were great days, and you engage with the fans too, which is what sort of made the relationship stronger, I reckon, Merv, too. Not many players would have done that, but you did, and you embraced it, which was fantastic. Hey, is there a ball that you've bowled through your career that you wish you could bowl again, that you just had an overfull of those?
What, because they were good or because they were bad, huh?
No, because they were good. Because they were good.
There's an over against England in Brisbane. I wish I could have back. I bowled to Ian Botham. I reckon it went 6.4.642. I wish I could have that back. Probably the delivery that really stands out at a pretty crucial part of the game. Lord's Test match 89. Must have been about the fourth day. England had batted, made 290. We batted and got a handy lead. And then we had England fired down for probably about 20, 30 runs behind. And Robin Smith and David Gower were putting a partnership together. And it was, I suppose from outside, it looked like it was just getting away from us. But new ball was coming up. So there was a lot of things in our favour. But they put on about 200. And just before the new ball was taken, Alan Border just got me bowling to David Gower. And I had Alan Border at mid-on. And he came over to me after a couple of balls. He said, "What are you thinking here?" I said, "Well, I'm thinking the length I'm going to be bowling to him, he's not going to get on the front foot and drive me down the ground because I want to tuck him up and get in into the ribs. So probably prefer you to go from mid-on to almost a leg gully, a backward square leg. So I reckon I'm a chance there." And AB just jogged to backward square leg. And then two balls later, into the rib cage, off the shoulder of the bat, straight to Alan Border. Now, two things really surprised me about this, I've got to be honest, is one, I actually thought about how to get a bat from now. And number two, Alan Border actually listened to me, which was unbelievable.
That is a real coming together of great minds. That is for one of the key wickets in that. And just, I need to explore more about the Julios and the Nerds. So the cricket team's broken it up into Julios and Nerds. The good-looking fellas hang out as the Julios. The other guys are the Nerds. You would have been a Julio, I'm sure, Merv, because you're a very handsome man.
You're killing me. No one wanted to be a Julio except the Julio. Seriously, the worst person in the team was the nerd that thought he was a Julio. And that wasn't me. So Steve Watts, him, mate, Ian Healy, myself. Mate, I still wear blue jeans and check shirts. I've had a look at my wardrobe. It hasn't changed for 30 years. So definitely in the nerd. But it was a real good, you know, the nerds had it all over the Julio. We had Mark Warren, Shane Warne a little bit later on. Glenn McGrath was just devastated. He thought he was a Julio, but he got dragged across the nerds and he just didn't want to be there. Oh, mate, you just got to accept it.
Is it still a thing?
I'm not sure. I reckon it would be, just simply because it really, really kept, funnily enough, it really kept the team together. And, yeah. And just the banter you had within the team was fantastic. So I'd be surprised if it wasn't, but to understand why. In this day and age, half political correctness, you can't label people, can you?
So, well, I reckon you can the cricket team.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a delicate situation these days.
That's an interesting point. Last one before I let you go. We've got to get rolling shortly. It's been great to chat with you, Merv. You, in another life, you're also an Australian cricket selector. If you were selecting the team for the Indian Test coming up, would you pick Will Pekoski?
Definitely the brave move is to pick him. The thing about the Australian selectors now is they've got so many options. But I think that Will, like Joe Burns, while he's struggled a bit, his performance in Australia have been fantastic. And his performance last year were pretty good. But I think to sit back and have a look at it, what Will Pekoski's done has been outstanding, and the brave move would be to pick him. So you'd think there'd only be one slot in that top six available. There's talk that Green may come in for Matthew Wade, and I'd be very surprised if that happened. So I think virtually Davey Warner opening, and then 3, 4, 5, and 6 are pretty well settled. But it's that number two spot that's up in the air, and if the selectors are brave, they'll pick Will Pekoski. And if they're not, I think we'll see Joe Burns play.
All right. Well, we'll see how they go with that. Great to spend some time with you, mate. Always a pleasure. We appreciate the time you've given us this morning. Stay well. We'll chat soon.
Okay, Harf. And Whitey, thanks very much. And I suppose it's that time of year, guys, to all your listeners and to you guys. Have a great Christmas. Safe and happy one.
Good stuff. You too. Great to have him a part of the program. Merv Hughes.